the law of God.
And I'm going to wrap myself in the mantle of a prophet and see if you can guess who I am. And I had a smile when Brother Paul Molly was up here. He singled out one of the brethren that was a doctor, and he singled out another brother who was a lawyer. And I thought, oh boy, he was the professor and he was giving out grades. So, oh, that someone would the gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us. Anyway, I am a priest and a prophet who tried to save the two-tribe kingdom of Judah from taking the course it did. Now, I don't want you to give an answer till I get done. Don't preempt me before I get to the end. I worked with another prophet who lived in Judah, and we both tried very hard to change the course of our people. While I lived in another land as a captive, yet I had extensive information on most things going on in Judah. I ministered also to some of God's people in captivity, and I was buried in Kipho. That's Arabian for my name. My name means God will strengthen. By the way, my writings almost did not make it into the Old Testament. I'm giving you a hint there. No one wanted to take the responsibility for translating my Chaldaic writings because they were so hard to make understandable. Finally, Rabbi Ananias said he would undertake to remove the difficulties of translation of some scenes that were almost beyond my poor abilities to describe. When Rabbi Ananias said he would undertake to remove the difficulties of translation, they decided then to add my book as a part of the canon of the scriptures. They also gave Rabbi Ananias 300 barrels of oil, thinking he would need it to burn the midnight oil in translating my book. Now I saw visions of God, and I knew that glory was departing from the holy city and the temple. By touching a lock of the Spirit's hair, I was transported to Jerusalem and told to dig in a wall where I saw unimaginable evils. I also saw visions of God's kingdom and what it would be like when that glorious time arrived. It was a wonderful experience, but you know, I was torn between two worlds. On the one hand, I had these glorious visions, and on the other hand, I was confronted with how badly God's people were behaving themselves. You know, being a prophet is not always easy. You foresee the terrible consequences that your people are going to endure for their wickedness, and you speak to them to tell them they must reform, but somehow they just walk right by you. They cannot believe we are telling them the truth. I am quoted quite often in Revelation, I live to see those who we tried to save from their self-destructive course go into captivity. Not that the captivity was all bad, because after this captivity, my people never again worship false gods. They never worship Baal or Moloch or any such gods again. I represented the Son of Man in some scenes, and possibly in others, Brother Russell. I also was blessed with visions concerning my people when they would be regathered step by step. Who am I? Ezekiel, that's right. And I'm glad you were able to pick that up. I wasn't trying to make it difficult. But Ezekiel, you know, was taken into captivity early on, and he was a priest, apparently a very high standing in Israel, and when he went in, he somehow managed to be in a situation where he was free to be active along his prophetic role. He was, of course, able to serve as a priest, but he put on a different mantle, and now he was changed from being a priest into a prophet. He was taken captivity with Jeconiah, king of Judah, and Jehoiachin succeeded Jeconiah to power, and about 3 years later, Jehoiachin was taken captive, and then finally Zedekiah was taken captive. Now, how do we know this prophet? There's two ways of knowing a person, and one way is to spend your time talking about little homilies of things that they did and try to get near to them as a person. Another way is to try to acquaint yourselves with how God used them in the ministry and how His Word came through them and how it affected Him. And so this is the latter way that we're going to follow. We can know people by their ministry just as well as we can from their small conversation and little homilies about their lives. And perhaps by knowing the ministry of others, we can know them better than by the homilies. First, Ezekiel saw really exalted visions. He saw visions of God's glory. In Ezekiel 1, verses 5 to 28, he sees a representation of God's glory. And he sees four living creatures. Each creature has four faces. It's different from Revelation, but the faces are the same. It has four faces of a man, each living creature. It has four faces of a lion. It has four faces of an ox and four faces of an eagle. And we would suggest that they represent justice, love, justice, power, and wisdom. Now, also he had wings, two sets of wings. That was two wings with which he flew and two wings to cover his body. So we see here that this was something unique. Other visions of God have shown him with six wings, but this is with four wings, and on top of that, these wings make an enormous amount of noise, like the sound of an earthquake. I've never been in one, but they say it's quite noisy. And it's like the sound of many waters and like the thunder of the Almighty, the sound of a tumult. So when these wings would move and flap, they would make an enormous sound. And apparently it was very, very impressive. And these wings had on their four sides human hands. Now the human hand is a symbol of power, but when the wings have hands all over the wing, it would accentuate the thought of power and show that the power in these wings was limitless. And also in this vision, and this is why it was so difficult to really translate, because in the first place it was in the Chaldaic language, and in the second place it was hard to describe these awesome visions, because he saw, along with these four living creatures, he saw huge wheels. And then in the hub, there was a hub in each wheel, a wheel within a wheel. But, you know, wheels normally spin when they move. These wheels didn't spin. They pulsed forth. You know, we do that in electronics, but, you know, it would be hard to describe that trying to, you know, for Ezekiel, who never saw anything move without spinning. So you could see that it was very, very difficult. But here we see a vision of the glory of God. The four attributes multiplied times four, 16, as though on every side he is represented by these attributes. And the wings are moving irresistibly forward toward a fulfillment of God's purpose. And also these wings are covering God's purpose, so that men, while they're looking on, they don't understand. They can't see the way God is moving and the direction He is taking. And these wheels, they pulse forth wherever the creatures, the four living creatures, move, and they apparently pulse forth, the wheels pulse forth with them, so that at no time is God not represented by His attributes and by these wheels, which are the purposes that he has in his eternal purpose. All right. We will press on here. We can't spend too much time with that vision. But in and the purpose of this is not to get into a detailed explanation, because it's an awfully big book. Just try to get the highlights. Ezekiel is referred to as the Son of Man. And in some regards, maybe he represents one of the messengers of the church. Ezekiel is especially commissioned to bear God's message to Israel. And in Ezekiel 2, 3 to 10, we read that he was addressing a nation of rebels who have rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me to this very day. The people also are impudent and stubborn. And I send you to them, and whether they hear or refuse to hear, they will know that there has been a prophet among them. God wants his people to speak, whether men bear or forbear. And the reason is he wants them to know that God has always had a mouthpiece here on earth. He has never been without a voice to represent him on earth. In chapter 3, we see a scroll is given to Ezekiel to eat. And it was to be sweet to the taste. We have something like this in Revelation, the 10th chapter, and the 8th to the 11th verses. And it is applied here, we believe, in Revelation to the John class, the Lord's people in the spirit-begotten condition on the Lord's day. The Lord prepares Ezekiel and us to realize that the world is not prepared to receive our message because they have hard foreheads and stubborn hearts. That's the way the Lord describes it. And then in Ezekiel 3:8, he says, "Behold, I have made your face hard against their face, and your forehead hard against their forehead. Like adamant, harder than flint, have I made your forehead. Fear them not, nor be dismayed at their looks, for they are a rebellious house. And most important, Son of Man, all my words that I shall speak to you, receive in your heart and hear with your ears." Don't just be a prophet, but you also attend to these words. And so Ezekiel was given a hard head. He could stand eyeball to eyeball with them, and he could, as it were, prevail in presenting the word of the Lord. Whether they accepted it or not, that was something else. But he wasn't going to be intimidated. That's the thought. He spoke the word of God. And that was it. They could not intimidate him. All right. And then we see he was called upon to do a little play acting. Only this was really difficult play acting. He was told to build a little city in the sand, and that was supposed to represent Jerusalem. And then he was to pantomime a siege against Jerusalem with a little model of the city set before him, and with battering rams and army camps all to show the siege of the city. Then he was to take an iron plate between him and his model city and let it be a state of siege and press the siege against it. So he had a little act to perform. Only thing, it wasn't, you know, an hour or two performance. How long do you suppose he had to perform? 390 days. He was tied on his left side, and he had to carry out the siege for 390 days. And then when he finished that, what next? He had to have another 40 days on his right side as the siege against Jerusalem, but this time to represent the other part of Christendom. The first one represented the part against Catholicism, the papacy, and the other segment, Judah, represented, we believe, in some figures, Protestantism. All right. We have a parallel of this in Revelation 9:15. There's a period there from the time from 1528 to 1918, which gives us 390 years, and then a 40-year siege from 1878 to 1918. But I don't have time to get into that, but that's to show that these things did have some antitypical significance, and there are identical periods of time to this in the New Testament. That's for your further study. All right, then in chapter 9, there was a man with a writer's inkhorn, and his task was to go through the city and to mark everyone that sighed and cried for the abominations that were done in the city. But that wasn't all. This man would go through the city, and he would mark this one, and he would mark that one, and he'd mark another one. But the ones that weren't marked, what was their lot? Well, it was a favor to be marked, because six men with slaughter weapons came through the city following the man with the inkhorn, and their job was to do some slaughtering work and to destroy faith in Christianity. And we believe that six men with slaughter weapons would perhaps represent what has taken place in our day with evolution, higher criticism, spiritism, Christian Science, theosophy, and psychology have invaded, as it were, the Christian church, and it has done what we feel is a faith-destroying work. It has taken away the efficacy of the blood of Christ, and suddenly man began to think in other terms. All right. And when this man with the writer's inkhorn, which I suspect most of you guess who he was, he reports that I have done as thou hast commanded me. Now, as long as his inkhorn was moving and marking those that sighed and cried for the abominations that were done, he could not render his report. And so this would not necessarily be related to his death, but until everyone had been marked with the inkhorn, that's when he would render his report. That's when the work would be done. When the sealing work was done, then he would render his report and say, I have done as thou hast commanded me. All right? But then he gets another assignment after that. And what is that? In the 10th chapter of Ezekiel, we find that his next assignment, after he had marked all those that sighed and cried for the abominations that were done, he was to go in on the altar, and from the altar he was to take coals of fire off the altar, and he was to scatter them over the city. He was to do a work of judgment. There were two works of judgment. There was one while he was sighing, as he went through the city marking those that were sighing and crying for the abominations that were done. There were men with slaughter weapons going through the city. But after this was all taken care of, then there was another judgment upon the city. And this was to scatter coals of fire over the city. All right. Then in chapter 18, and I love this chapter because God says in this chapter, your ways are not equal, but my ways are equal. And he says, when a man sins, he will die. If he converts from his sins, he will live. And so again, we see how the Lord has an equal hand in dealing with people. All right, then we come to the chapter 23, and I'm skipping through it because it's a large, large book. There's Ahola and Aholaba. Ahola we understand to represent Samaria of the northern kingdom, the 10-tribe kingdom, and then there was Aholaba, which would represent the other part of the kingdom. And there was to be a work done here in judging Ahola and Aholaba. And then also Ezekiel did what all the other prophets did. They showed how God punished his people for their unfaithfulness. But then, you know, in the scriptures, the Lord also shows how he punishes the enemies of his people. So God's ways are equal that way too. He punishes his people when they do not live up to his standards, but he also punishes the enemies of his people. And among those that were the enemies of his people, which was natural Israel back there, was Tyre. You know, Tyre was a remarkable city. What made it unique is that it had two parts to it. They had the mainland of Tyre, was a big and strong city, but also they had a little island fortress out in the water. And many times invading armies would come and they would attack the main part of the city. And if the siege got too hot for them, the people of Tyre would do what? They would move over to the island, which was fortified. They had plenty of food. They had fish. They had everything they needed to endure a limitless siege. And so many times they were attacked and they couldn't be reached. But finally, Alexander the Great came along, and he wasn't so easily discouraged. He did what Ezekiel said he would do. He raised the part of the city that was the mainland, and he took all the rubble and the stones, and he built the causeway out to this island. And then he was able to tear down its walls, and he was able to vanquish that city. And if we think of that as the papacy, how true that is. They have had two lines of defense. And when this outer perimeter was invaded, they would always retreat to their secondary fortress. But in the end, the Lord is going to move and take them in their secondary fortress. And also, there are prophecies against Egypt and so on. The 36th chapter of Ezekiel, I think it brings out a great truth. And one of those truths is in Ezekiel 36, 24 to 25, where he says, I will take you, he's talking about natural Israel, from among the nations and gather you from all the countries and bring you into your own land. And we have lived to see the fulfillment of that prophecy. We have seen the children of Israel regathered in the land that was promised to them. Now, what's unique about this prophecy that it makes it clear. Some people think that God would have no dealings with natural Israel because they are unclean. They don't accept the Messiah. Well, the truth of the matter is he says he would regather them into their land and then he would sprinkle clean water upon you and you shall be clean from all your uncleanness. And so we see that first he regathers them. And then he sprinkles the clean water upon them. And so that helps us also in prophecy. Then we come to Ezekiel's temple. Well, we know that Ezekiel saw the visions of God's temple. And while that temple was not built, all the instructions for building it were given. And this temple also, what was unique about it, it paralleled the vision of Revelation. Because in the Garden of Eden, first of all, remember there was a river. And where did it flow out from? From Eden, didn't it? And the river then split into four branches and it watered the whole earth. But in Ezekiel's prophecy, there's another river. This one is pure as crystal. And it comes from where? Underneath the throne. And its waters flow down the banks toward the Dead Sea. And as it reaches the Dead Sea, what happens? The waters are healed. I think Brother George has that in his slide presentation. Most of the waters are healed. And that pictures how that when the kingdom is set up and these living waters reach the nations and the peoples, that they will again be refreshed and become living in his sight. And the Arabah, which it flows through, which was dry and arid, would become a flourishing area again. And there would be trees on either side. And so this is paralleled in Revelation. So Ezekiel's visions were very great. He saw some of the most beautiful scenes, and he described them in the most beautiful language. And he is copied and quoted a great deal in the New Testament, but especially, most of all, in the book of Revelation. May the Lord add his blessing.